You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS
and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, April 9th, 2013. My name is Matt Binder.
I'm Michael Brooks.
And this is The Majority Report. We are broadcasting live from the... Whoa, I just had a mental block here. We're broadcasting live from the literal but not metaphorical shadow of the New York Times building
in the fashionable Dollar Lunch district of New York City. Sam Cedar, ill today.
Very ill. If you were listening to the show yesterday, you might have wondered who that man on the other end of your podcast machine was.
Yeah.
Because he did not sound like Sam Cedar.
Did not sound like a full Sam Cedar. Michael Brooks, also a little bit sick. But still up for pinch hitting for Boss Cedar.
Matt Binder, not sick in the general terms of sick, but I am a bit out of it still.
With recovery and hangover from WrestleMania madness this past weekend.
Yes, yes, that's exactly it.
That was, where was that? That's in New Jersey?
It was in New Jersey this year, yes.
So what actually happens during WrestleMania?
Well, basically, I guess we should put the music down for this because it's
yeah,
very important.
Yeah, I
kind of
want to know.
Maybe we should talk about this in the better half. Let's get to the show, and then I promise you all your wrestling
not
talk
even
will
as
be...
like a little appetizer.
Fine. I went to 5 wrestling events in 4 days, basically, this past
all
weekend.
All right, folks, I just wanted you to see
so there
Matt,
you go.
Matt's pathology here. we'll get to more of it in the better half of the show. Actually, it will be interesting. It's like discovering a whole new subculture that I certainly don't know anything about, and I'm sure most of our listeners don't know anything about.
It'll be fun.
It will be fun. Great show today, folks. We're actually going to be holding it down without a guest today because there's a lot of great and important stories to go over. We're going to be talking about the Margaret Thatcher legacy in a couple of different parts. I think, you know, for better and pretty much very much for worse, we're living in her world. So there's a lot to get over with her. We're going to be talking about this new video. Mitch McConnell apparently had a strategy for questioning Ashley Judd's mental health, which mental health questioning is an interesting strategy to be pursued by Mitch McConnell, and a lot of other great stuff. But I want to start off briefly with, did you know that Jay-Z and Beyonce went to Cuba to celebrate their 5th anniversary?
I heard.
So basically, Jay-Z and Beyonce are in Cuba. People can get approval to go to Cuba by the Treasury Department for basically what are called educational exchange activities that will result in meaningful interaction. That's the policy.
Mm.
So
how could I apply to that one? Sounds like a good time.
It sounds like a really good time. And that's clearly what they're having. I mean, Jay is smoking Cuban cigars on hotel balconies. They went to go see the Cuban contemporary dance company. They went to go see a bunch of Cuban school children perform. And as you can imagine, this has led to a complete meltdown by Republicans. They want to know who approved the trip. Why is this like a special favor to Jay-Z that he got approval to go to Cuba? And I just have to say, like, if this was the payoff for all the work that Jay-Z and Beyonce did for the Obamas, I think that's pretty innocuous. You know, like other donors are calling up and asking for, the tax code to be rewritten to benefit them. They want all sorts of riders and things like the Trans-Pacific trade deal. All that stuff is you know, regularly called in on a daily basis by lobbyists and donors. If Jay-Z and Beyonce just want to go to Cuba, I think that's cool.
You know what? That's a very nice way to look at it. I mean, I think that's the truth. I mean, that is
pretty benign.
Yeah, this is
campaign
got
payoff.
It there. I mean,
yeah, we would like to take a couple day vacation to Cuba. It also gave Marco Rubio an opportunity. Now, folks, I don't know how many people notice, but Marco Rubio is one of these guys who thinks that basically the fact that he listened to, you know, Tupac in law school is his bridge to connecting with that other America that that no Republicans can connect to. So he kind of shows up and is like, does his, you know, real estate investment scam pitch, and then quotes, you know, Wiz Khalifa lyrics. So this puts him in a bind because he represents Florida and he needs to demagogue this issue to the fullest. But he also clearly loves Jay-Z and doesn't want to alienate Jay-Z. So how does Marco Rubio try to square this circle here?
By being the hip cat that Marco Rubio is.
Exactly. So besides, you know, releasing the usual statement, which, okay, fair enough, any politician would do about the Castro regime using this trip for propaganda, Marco Rubio is also tweeting at Jay-Z, saying Jay-Z should have visited. Rubio tweeted, interested in what life is really like in Cuba, should have S_C, as in that's Sean Carter, which is, of course, Jay-Z's birth name, should have visited prosecuted rapper Angel Yunier Remen, hashtag 99 problems and dictators are one.
Oh! Jay-Z got served!
He got so served. That's, of course, playing off of the famous Jay-Z, I have 99 problems. And I don't know if I can say the title of the song, actually. Is that cool for DC?
I got 99 problems, but a B-I-T-C-H-A one. How
right.
about that?
That is, that's the famous Jay-Z song. And what's amazing is that, once again, it's not like a completely illegitimate point. Matt's just like spitting Arizona iced tea in his nose after he did that.
Oh, man.
God.
I can't believe Marco Rubio. He thinks, I mean, that rapper you just mentioned from Cuba. I mean, you think Marco Rubio pulled that out of the top of his head, please? He spent some time on Wikipedia for that one.
What's great is that there are people persecuted in Cuba. And look, even though obviously in the context of this trip, Jay-Z is not going to meet with this person, that's like a completely legitimate thing to raise. That, yes, you know, you're going to go and take a nice vacation in Cuba, and there are people put in jail for speaking out, and there is serious political repression there. That's just true. And then he has to totally destroy his own point by sending out a moronic tweet that isn't even like a clever playoff of 99 problems. So basically this Cuba trip gives us another opportunity for Marco Rubio to just be a moron, which is what he is. He's a complete idiot. And I mean, I just thought, like, the only thing I'll just cap this thread by saying, whatever else you think of President Obama, the fact that Republicans say Marco Rubio is their equivalent of President Obama shows how deluded they are and how what trouble they're going to have getting back into fighting shape. Because this guy can't even really give a speech that doesn't seem like an infomercial for real estate investment scams you're watching at 3 a.m. And he's just clearly not that bright. So anyways, we're going to take a brief break. We're going to go over the Thatcher legacy, although arguably in some ways some of the types of capitalism that Jay-Z has advocated in his records over the years is part of the Thatcher legacy as well, one might argue. So
okay.
So let's take a little break.
I don't know if you could argue that. If you want to go ahead and do it,
I might argue that after the break.
All right, let's do it.
All right, bro, we'll be back in a few minutes, folks. I was doing a Rubio there myself. We'll be back in a minute. Thanks for tuning in. My man. Speech. First of all, I want to thank my connect, the most important person with all due respect. Thanks to the duffel bag, the brown paper bag, the Nike shoe box for holding all this cash. Okay. Boys in blue who agreed before the badge. Okay. The first push who ever made the stash. Okay. The rock boys in the building tonight. Hey. Oh, what a feeling I'm feeling life. Hey. Thanks to the lanes. Bad aim. Thanks to a little change. Up the cane, bullet wounds will stop your buffoonery. Thanks to the pastor rapping at your eulogy.
G's to Little Kim and them. You know the women friend who carry the work cross state for a gentleman. Yeah, thanks to all the hustlers, and most importantly you, the customer. The rock boys in the building tonight. Hey. Oh, what a feeling I'm feeling like. Hey. You don't even gotta bring your paper out. We the dope boys of the year. Drinks is on the house. The rock boys in the building tonight. Hey. Look at how I'm chilling, I'm killing this ice. Hey. You don't even gotta bring your purses out. We the dope boys of the year. Drinks is on the house.
We in the house. We in the house.
On the planet, kick a shawl, take what the fall is bigger than figure more, cause they forgot to account what I did with the fraud. Pick a timeless, pick a pass of stars, pick a weekend for freaking for figure falls. I figure frauds never hit a lick before, so they don't know the feeling when them things get across. Put your hand out the window, feel a force, feel a posh, hit the frost, ice cold, shoes got no flaws, drop got no top, you on the top floor, pink rosé, think OJ. I get away with murder when I sling yay. Hebron got less steps than Britney. That means it ain't stepped on. Dig me.
Welcome back. Giving you a little Jay-Z there after that story. So I want to talk about Margaret Thatcher, and we're going to go into two different parts of her legacy. But I think before we get to this, there's something really important just to establish. There's this great Glenn Greenwald piece that he published just yesterday, I think, called Margaret Thatcher and Misapplied Death Etiquette. And because, you know, you see this after public figures die. There's this rush, and including public figures as, you know, not Margaret Thatcher's stature, Ronald Reagan's stature, like even on the level of just some, you know, malicious kind of, you know, grade D propagandist like Andrew Breitbart, who really has nothing, you know, significant or historical to his legacy. All of a sudden, we, you know, we can't say anything critical about them, even though the only reason we know who they are and we're speaking about them is their public records. It has nothing to do. We're not speaking as family. We're not speaking as friends. We're speaking as people who have engaged with them in a public way. And if their public records are toxic, they're toxic and they should be spoken about. So anyways, Glenn Greenwald writes in regards to people immediately rushing out in the United States and the UK to demand that there be no kind of critical rhetoric about Thatcher. And I actually just want to point out, Martin Bashir on MSNBC has been doing a great job in his segments of really giving a fuller picture of the Thatcher legacy and has been getting a huge amount of hate and pushback for doing this. So he deserves a lot of credit for that. Greenwald writes, "This demand for respectful silence in the wake of a public figure's death is not just misguided, but dangerous. That one should not speak ill of the dead is arguably appropriate when a private person dies, but it is wildly inappropriate for the death of a controversial public figure, particularly one who wielded significant influence and political power." And then he goes on to say, "The key point here is that those who admired the deceased public figure and their politics aren't silent at all." So we saw this with Reagan, and we're seeing this with Thatcher. It's a two-step. One is the generic, you can't say anything bad about them because a person has just died. Okay, so a person just dying, of course, I'm not happy about that. I don't take any pleasure in that. I don't take, you know, anything in that. I don't have any personal relationship with Margaret Thatcher, and neither do, you know, 99.9% of people commenting on this. So that's sort of neither here nor there. But then the next step is to valorize and try to justify everything they did. Like they have these great heroic legacies. And then you've got a two-step where you have one week of a news cycle, which everybody's being policed about what they can say about her in terms of even just an objective analysis of her legacy, let alone a critical one. And then everything she did is slid under that. And you saw this with Reagan for a week. And that's why, and it should be clear, in an American context, the Thatcher drumbeat is inseparable from the Reagan drumbeat. That's why it's such a big deal here. So, I mean, I don't know. Do you have like a different take on this notion of speaking ill about the dead, or even thinking about a dead public figure in that way to begin with seems kind of ludicrous.
You could speak ill of anybody, dead or alive. I'm all for holding people accountable to what they have done, whether it's good or bad.
That's exactly right. You have to hold people – right, exactly. And then this kind of sanctimonious policing of what we can say isn't just – but I think it's really key that it's not just that it's sanctimonious policing. There's a very specific political agenda behind it, because you want to take Margaret Thatcher and her political legacy out of dispute. That's when you do when you valorize somebody for a week. You take them out of the realm of public discussion when that's exactly what they are. They're a piece of public discussion. You know, I remember with Andrew Breitbart, who I would – again, I would never compare Andrew Breitbart to Margaret Thatcher, okay? There's some objective things, being the first female UK prime minister. Margaret Thatcher is a substantive human being. I mean, Andrew Breitbart, no one will even remember in a couple of years besides Louis Gohmert when he, you know, goes and has a good cry at his local tavern every, you know, anniversary of Andrew Breitbart's death. But, you know, people would say when Breitbart died, well, you know, it's really sad that a guy die in his 40s died with young children. And of course that's sad, but frankly, like
– you can easily separate their personal lives with what they've done as a public figure or business.
That's exactly right. And not only that, I mean, look, on the level of – it's sad that a father died prematurely. Some guy like laying lines for Verizon probably died prematurely as a 42-year-old. No one's discussing him. And what did he do in the public? That he didn't do anything bad. He helped make – you know, put power lines up. And nobody's talking about him or talking about how sad that is. The only public implications of an Andrew Breitbart, again, are totally toxic. And that should be what we're talking about.
Yeah, exactly.
So, you know, that so it's I think, again, it's not even like – and I know, you know, in Britain, there's the other extreme. Some people are hosting, like, celebration parties that she died, which I do, like, think legitimately is kind of tasteless. But the point is, in a place where people actually have to live under her and deal with her, none of this, you know, romanticism is going on. There's a real debate about it.
I think those parties are pretty funny.
Matt thinks those parties are pretty funny. That's why I brought it up, because I thought you would think those parties were funny.
I mean, if you're a political figure and decisions you've made have cost people's lives, most likely. I mean, there probably is – you could argue that every political figure has cost someone a life regardless of where on the what government level they're at. But I mean – it's just, who cares? They're dead. Seriously, they're not hearing it. They don't hear it. I mean, please.
Well, their family.
Oh, please.
Anyways, regardless.
If Margaret Thatcher's family was sitting on Twitter yesterday checking out what tweets were coming out with her, I'd have to say to them, get a life. Margaret Thatcher just died. Why don't you take care of what needs to be taken care of?
I have to say, if it's a story for another day, but if you do read about something for kids, they totally could have been sitting on Twitter yesterday. they don't have much going on. But at any rate, moving on to the – so, again, it's vital to talk about her legacy, and it's vital that in general, you know, when anybody dies, I saw that with, you know, look on the opposite end of the spectrum. Have a full conversation about Chavez. Nobody was talking about, oh, it's, you know, we need to be quiet because his family's mourning. No, he's a public figure. You assess a public figure. It seems
I quietly mourn.
Which is your right. Which is your
that
right.
That was very solemn that day.
That was a solemn day. So I want to talk about two different aspects, though, of the Thatcher legacy. And I think one, which is just kind of the most glaring, because there's kind of two ways of thinking about the Thatcher legacy. One, there's a kind of unacknowledged consensus in some ways that she's about things that she was actually completely wrong about, to the point where David Cameron, who's the conservative UK prime minister, has actually apologized on her behalf. And then other areas in terms of economics and social policy where she Thatcherism still kind of reigns supreme, frankly. But first, let's look at what Margaret Thatcher's attitude was towards apartheid South Africa when she was Prime Minister of the UK, and specifically towards Nelson Mandela. So this is what she said. And you know, bear in mind, Nelson Mandela was still imprisoned by the apartheid regime when Margaret Thatcher came to power in several years through her premiership. She said about Nelson Mandela, she called Nelson Mandela and the African National Congress, which was the, you know, Liberation Party of South Africa, that Nelson Mandela was and the ANC was a typical terrorist organization. And she and even as the international community came together across party lines to apply sanctions to the white apartheid Afrikaner government in South Africa, Thatcher opposed sanctions, calling for a policy of what she called constructive engagement. Now, I don't know what that means, but what it seemed to mean in practice was opposing sanctions and calling Nelson Mandela a terrorist. So in South Africa, speaking of the opposite end of the spectrum of reaction to Thatcher, look at this tweet. Someone tweeted out, Mandela outlived Thatcher. 1-0 freedom. History is the ultimate judge. That's one tweet that went out in South Africa in reaction to Thatcher's death.
What was it again?
You missed that?
One more time. I just want to make sure I got it.
Mandela outlived Thatcher. 1-0 freedom. History is the ultimate judge.
Okay. That last line, I picture George Bush say something like that. That'll be a tweet about me when I go.
Tweet when... when everybody recognizes sometime out in the distance that I just was sort of like Charlie Sheen said, winning.
to quote the great Charlie Sheen.
Quote the great Charlie Sheen. Now, of course, Margaret Thatcher wasn't just atrocious in South Africa. She was atrocious in Chile. She said and I think Pinochet, this is another thing that we could kind of get to, because this serves dual purposes. Because on one hand, this is another example of Thatcher. Look, the reality of being in government, I think, is that sometimes you're going to have relationships and engagement with unsavory players. Okay, so that I think, and governments of all kinds, you know, in fact, the ANC government, which currently runs South Africa, which came out of the apartheid struggle, has, disinvited the Dalai Lama from a Nobel Prize laureate event a couple years ago because they didn't want to offend China and jeopardize arms deals with China. So this is a cross-political thing. But when you talk about Chile, so just think about this. Margaret Thatcher called Nelson Mandela a terrorist. Now, Augusto Pinochet, who came to power in Chile in 1973 in a military coup, organized opposition people and opposition politicians in soccer stadiums, had them killed en masse, and pioneered a way of killing people which was used in Argentina and by a number of right-wing junta governments in Latin America, where you would take people in helicopters, drug them so they passed out, cut their stomachs open, throw them out of the plane so they could sink into the ocean. And their families would have no way of kind of tracing or recovering the body. So this is Pinochet's human rights record. And he did this all with the support of course, not only Thatcher, but also, the United States. The coup happened under the Nixon administration. Kissinger was very close with Pinochet. Now, in the late 80s, Pinochet, under an agreement where he had lifetime immunity for all of his serial human rights abuses, did agree to have a referendum to transition Chile back to democracy. So Thatcher said that Augusto Pinochet was the man responsible for bringing democracy to Chile. After he overthrew a democratically elected government, killed tens of thousands of people, jailed opposition leaders, had people tortured, then he agreed to a referendum where he would have lifelong immunity, and Margaret Thatcher came away with he brought democracy to Chile. But of course, from Margaret Thatcher's perspective, another big fan of Pinochet libertarian listeners was Milton Friedman, because Pinochet, while he was committing these horrific human rights abuses, was privatizing government industries and slashing social spending. So he was held up as this great model for free markets. So I guess markets and freedom don't always come together. But you got it. But again, so but I think
what?
I know.
Huh?
Huh?
What?
Totally shocking. Again, I'm just.
Wow.
Exactly. So basically, those are, and then of course, also she was very friendly with the Saddam Hussein regime in the 80s when you know he was still on the right side of things. General Suharto in Indonesia, who also had a horrific human rights record. So that's part of the Thatcher legacy, which we should all be talking about. Now, I want to go into another part of the Thatcher legacy that I think we definitely still live with. And before I do that, I want to play a clip of Billy Bragg, who's the great British protest songwriter, activist, and musician.
Oh, wait. Give me a second.
We need a second. So basically, look, Margaret Thatcher is known for there's no question that when she came to power in Britain, the country was stagnating. The economy was sluggish. There was a lot of kind of cozy relationships between certain aspects of the business community, labor, government. Britain wasn't sort of moving, and the economy was deeply stagnant. Now, her answer to this was the answer that we've seen was Reagan's answer in America, and the answer we're still living the consequences of. Oh, do we have that sound?
Go ahead.
Collective responsibility, collective provision. And as a singer-songwriter who'd grown up listening to Bob Dylan and Woody Guthrie and the Clash, it seemed to me that my place was to be, you know, there on the picket line playing songs. And it was interesting because it was a bit of an education for me because I didn't go to college, so I didn't know a huge amount about socialism. So it was a very steep learning curve. They wanted to know why this pop singer from London had come up to the coalfields, sitting up late at night on sofas with people, drinking cups of tea, smoking cigarettes, talking about politics. And so, yeah, I can tell you that the great inspiration in my politics was Margaret Thatcher. Were it not for her, I probably wouldn't be a socialist.
So I play that clip because I think he actually is giving a great historical overview, because Thatcher came in at a time when you had a consensus in the UK and really arguably a consensus across a lot of industrialized countries, which was fraying. It was running into some trouble. But nonetheless, there was a consensus that you're going to have universal services. You're going to have anti-poverty programs. You're going to have a role for labor. You're going to have, in some respects, a collaborative decision-making process between the government, the private sector, and the public sector. Now, she came in to ruthlessly break all that up. And the narrative that we hear mostly in America and that has kind of reigned through the 80s and 90s, and I think particularly when credit was easily available and we were living through the tech bubble and the financial bubble, that this has sort of been the narrative, I think, arguably, really up and through the 2007, the 2008 financial crash, which was that what Thatcher and Reagan did was destroy these monopolies in the public sector, unleash the power of the market, and raise living standards for everybody. Now, that's the kind of comfortable part of the narrative. Now, there's two really big problems with that, obviously. And one is what I love is about that clip that Billy Bragg is talking about is that it wasn't like this was anywhere remotely a consensus process while it was happening. And in order for her to unleash the power of the market, this organic, freedom-loving thing, she needed to unleash police power on protesters. She needed to unleash the state to literally destroy the domestic coal industry in Wales just so she could destroy that union. That was the purpose of unleashing that. And this is actually really where, I know a lot of people write in and reference Naomi Klein's shock doctrine. And I think that arguably in some ways, even more radically in the United States, Margaret Thatcher really implemented a shock doctrine on the UK. It was a very violent and controversial process, which led up to her actually proposing a poll tax, which is what eventually kind of led to even her own party dumping her at the end because she had proven so controversial, caused so much violence and so much agitation. So that's the first part of that narrative, was that, you know, this easy narrative is that all the unions were corrupt and the whole process was corroded. And look, that's not entirely untrue. But the way she did it and what she grew out of it was incredibly brutal and incredibly one-sided and showed a complete disregard for people's livelihoods. Now, the second thing, and I think the other legacy that we still play out with too, is that the premise, though, of that first – of what she came up against being like outdated and outmoded and corroded rests on the assumption that what she put in its place is sustainable and robust and resilient. And we all know that that is complete nonsense. Because what does she put in its place? She hollowed out the industrial sector of Britain, okay? So – just like in the United States, you go through large swaths of America and you see places that essentially are bombed out. They're totally deindustrialized. You know, people don't have work. There isn't opportunity for people to live middle-class lives without, higher levels of education. And even obviously that's getting called into question in today's world. And she replaced it with deregulated financial sector, and an explosion of consumption, genuinely on the top end because they were making way more money, and in the middle class because credit was more readily available. So that's the world we live in. And I think the most disturbing thing is that, you know, if ever where there was a time for – and then I think the other kind of historical step is that guys like Clinton and Blair came in. And their whole policy was this is basically the framework we're governed under, but we're going to soften the edges. We'll provide more training for people. We'll protect some social programs. And that was kind of the arrangement. And arguably, even though there was a lot of horrible things that came with that, there wasn't that much of an appetite for a different politics. Now, President Obama, with doing things that he has genuinely accomplished, like healthcare reform and things like that, he is kind of a great third way leader, which is the name of that brand of politics. The only problem is that totally doesn't work in today's age, if it ever worked to begin with. Because if ever there was time for a serious counter-reformation, it was when all of this stuff blew up in our faces in 2008, the cheap credit and everything else, too, that they set into motion, which was the never-ending reliance and the notion that we can have continuing cheap oil supplies, cheap energy supplies, and all the rest. So this rests on really faulty assumptions. I think what Billy Bragg shows, though, and what's inspiring about that is that this has never been taken passively. There's always been activism. There's always been a fight back. And as these policies work for less and less people, and as we become more thoughtful, in some respects, hopefully, I think that there is opening to start to lay the groundwork in the long term for what we really need. And that goes way beyond, again, and I think this is one of the reasons that I don't, you know, go strongly in either way with President Obama, because I never thought President Obama was going to save us from this to begin with. And I don't think he's to blame for a lot of these structures that are in place that he inherited. Now, I wish he was responding to them differently, and I find things like the budget proposal atrocious, but I think that he's operating in a context that was set long before him and that needs to be fundamentally changed. And a big part of that fundamental change is going to come through activism. It's going to come through different types of business. It's going to come through different types of organizing. It's going to come through reclaiming the commons and a lot of other things that are maybe kind of left for a different day. But I think the best part of Margaret Thatcher's legacy is if we can actually sit down and really talk about what she actually did unleash and all the ways in which it's proven unsustainable and a mistake.
I'm going to edit everything that you just said because she's deceased and we need to respect the deceased. Today's show will be just what, 15, 20 minutes of dead air.
Why don't we just play a loop of Margaret Thatcher, Margaret Thatcher speeches?
I think that's what I'll do. Very, very good.
Yeah. I mean, I know. I realize what I did was pretty disgusting.
I am disgusted with you.
It was sick.
You're a sick man, Michael Brooks.
The notion
sick man.
Of talking about Margaret Thatcher a couple days after her death is... it's grotesque. I'm ashamed of myself.
As well you should
as
be.
As well I should be. All right. Want to go into one final thing here, and then we're going to get into the better half of the program.
Interesting how I take the reins for the better half.
Better half in this sense is the way kids who are, like, cut from the best little league teams are told that they're in, like, the better league.
I'm throwing mad shade at Michael Brooks right
yeah,
now.
Yeah, I'm getting serious shade over here. Like intense. So, but I just have to say parenthetically, I really wish I had the Lindsey Graham story because I have never been able to play the
don't
the door.
Use it because we didn't say his name. You're not allowed to use it. Don't.
I'm not allowed to use it because that was too forced.
That was too forced.
I agree with you. Okay, so the final thing here, I want to just do a quick thing on President Obama's budget proposal, which obviously Sam's spoken about a lot. And I think there's kind of two quick things to cover here. You know, Bill Scheer, who we all know is probably the biggest, very, very strong Obama supporter, and was on, wasn't he on in the summer to argue about Obama with Sam?
I think he, wait, who?
Bill Scheer.
Bill Scheer. He was, yes. Yeah. I was trying to remember the exact, yeah.
Sometime in the summer.
No, because he was on, he's been on before. So I was trying to remember if he was on specifically as.
But didn't he have like a specific like showdown on like the Obama?
Yes, there was. And I think it was framed too as they were going to try to not make it a showdown, if I remember correctly. He was on before that though, where they got into it about Obama when he wasn't on the show to talk about that specifically.
I think even the, like, let's not make it a showdown became a showdown. But
yes,
at any rate,
that's what I'm talking about.
But at any rate, look, Bill Scheer wrote a piece in The Week a couple of weeks ago where he made it, and this is interesting thinking from someone who's so supportive of Obama, and I think it reveal. I think there's two ways of thinking about Obama's approach on the budget, which I want to use this article to get into briefly. So basically, the name of the piece was Why Obama's Legacy Doesn't Need a Grand Bargain. So, you know, obviously you just, if you're accepting Bill's premise here that Obama's already accomplished a lot through things like the stimulus and healthcare and all the rest. But where it gets interesting is he talks about the things that we remember presidents for doing as great accomplishments are mostly programs, right? So we remember whether it's Lyndon Johnson and Medicare or Eisenhower's interstate highway system or, Teddy Roosevelt and National Park System. And he gives several other examples. And then he talks about why fiscal deals are unsustainable as legacies because they change. They're so susceptible to change in political currents. And he talks about Bill Clinton's budget surplus, which is a great example of this. So Bill Clinton, as we all know, left office with a great, you know, with a balanced budget, big surplus. And that, you know, and as Bill says, that's a good Democratic talking point. But what happened to that surplus? Well, one former Clinton aide lamented, what it turned out what we had done in the end was enable George W. Bush's right-wing class war. Because all those surpluses just turned into Bush's massive tax breaks for the top 1% or 2%. So even that fiscal accomplishment didn't last a year after the Clinton presidency. So the point being here that even if some grand bargain, grand portrayal was stuck, there's no historical precedent for that like lasting. So it's a foolish thing to expend political capital on. And I have to say, I think that there are two – and again, I think that there's two ways of thinking about this in the Obama White House. I think, yeah, I'm convinced that Obama really does want this deal, and I think it's horrible. And I think the things that he's proposed are totally atrocious. Call your congressman, pressure against it. But I think that they think it's a win either way because I think that the other way that the Obama people see this is that – they come out with these proposals on a pretty regular basis that are right-wing proposals that meet more than halfway what the Republicans are always ranting and raving about, and then Republicans always reject them. And what happens is that mostly the story is, look at that, you know, Obama seems like a reasonable guy and Republicans are crazy. Now, I don't think that this strategy is sustainable because I think you can only so long can you go out and push for policies that, of course, the actual center of America hates, like slashes in Medicare and Social Security. But I think that that's the political thinking behind these continued pushes. I think, one, in the worst case scenario, I think it's true, they actually do want a deal like this, and they're committed to it, and they believe in it, and that's absurd. I think the second way they process it is they can keep winning points on Republicans and having Republicans own goal themselves, because Republicans always look so unreasonable because Obama's constantly trying to basically give them what they want. And I think, you know, again, I think in either scenario, it's another reason why we need a left that is needs to be catered to and present in the debate as well. What do you say?
Once again, you're on point. I mean, there's nothing for me to add to that. Jeez.
Anyways, well, you always have something to add, my friend. Look, we are going to go into the better half of the show shortly. We want your calls. We want your IMs. We have stories from WrestleMania. We have Mitch McConnell being an absolute scumbag to Ashley Judd in anticipation of her running against him. We have
this hilarious clip of the Fox and Friends guys going off on the striking fast food workers last week in New York City. And boy, are they angry.
Yeah. That's either one of those clips that's going to make you laugh or
if
make you...
If Ducey can't get his McDouble, there's going to be war, people.
Yeah, that's right, because really...
If Kilmeade can't get his Big Mac, we're going to have some problems.
Could you imagine having, like, a system of corporate feudalism to serve
Brian, where's Brian Gretchen Kilmeade? Carlson's Whopper, damn it!
So disgusting. But please, if you're a libertarian... And you want to take Matt on. And look, if Dan from New Jersey calls, that's awesome. We'll take all comers. Although I just want to say in advance, I will not discuss student loans with you. That's done.
Libertarians, but please call in. Please.
Give them
the libertarian line. We have a special line for you. It's up there on the upper left-hand side, right on the screen. It's taped on the screen.
I don't see that. Oh, there's a special libertarian number. It is 646-257-3920.
That is the regular number.
Oh, that's the regular number?
Yeah, that's the regular number.
I'm too dyslexic to follow how Sam usually does that. Anyways, we're going to give the number out in the second half of the show. Folks, please stick around.
Libertarians, call that number too.
Call that number too. I have enough faith in libertarians that...
Become a member today at Majority.fm. Follow us on Twitter, at Majority.fm, on Facebook, Facebook.com/Majority Report, on YouTube, YouTube.com/Sam Cedar. We are live on YouTube every day at the same time we have the show where you listen to us on the either your podcasting application or whether you listen to us on the live stream on the site. You can donate your account at DonateYourAccount.com and... You can give us one retweet or one Facebook share per day. That's, you know, a lot of people really like that because, you know, if you're not at your computer that day, automatically shares whatever video we put out that day. And a lot of people say it's great because their friends and family or Twitter followers, Facebook friends, they get into little discussions on the video. So it's – people enjoy that.
It's a great way of engaging. Look, and Sam, I got to tell you, just seeing him sick yesterday, like – he just puts in so much work in this show. And frankly, we all do. But particularly Sam. And if you can...
Michael, what's...
Come remember.
There was something on your nose right there, Michael.
Dude, save it when we're not doing the money pitch. This is what... You never learn the lessons of Thatcher. You never mess around when money's at stake.
No. Sam needs the money, not because he works hard, but because...
He has a little baby.
He has a little baby.
Yeah,
yes.
Sam doesn't really work that hard. It's pretty much...
No, I'm just joking.
The reality is that if Sam didn't have this show, he'd just be harassing his wife about the Simpson Bowls budget. So both for, like, the sanity of the Cedar household and to give the kid organic baby milk or organic baby food, become a member today.
And you know what? As Sam has mentioned, you know, we get more members. We don't just, you know, keep riding it as we are with extra money in our pockets, you know, making it rain on ourselves or something. You know, you give up, we get more members. The show quality goes up. We're able to get more people in here. Maybe add more content even. I mean, we already put out a ton of it.
Well, you put out so much content, but we will tell you that there is there's a little Matt and Mike thing brewing. But anyways, look, folks, become a member, see you in the better half of the show.